Coming up on Tech News Weekly, I am back. Jason Howell is here. That's right. We are ready to roll. We've got a huge show. Up first, David Ruddock of Android Police is here to talk about the Samsung Galaxy Unpacked event. What can we expect? What can we not expect? And what might we expect? It's all of that and so much more. Plus, Stacey Higginbotham is here to give us a little bit of an insight into the HeyG Smart Home Summit. Google has a lot to tell us about the smart home and what it is offering in the future before we round things out with a conversation with Don Reisinger about Quibi and its not so fruitful future. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly. Tech News Weekly is brought to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes security simple for your remote workforce. Check out lastpass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 141, recorded Thursday, July 9th, 2020. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including OEMs like Dell EMC. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit.
And by Hover. Do you have a domain name that truly represents you and your passion? Well, visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year.
And by LastPass. Give your IT department a break and supply them with the tools that really protect your business. Visit lastpass.com/twit to find out how they can help you.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly. We are back in the saddle. Of course, this is the show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news every week. I'm Micah Sargent.
And I'm Jason Howell. Good to see you, Micah. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, sir. It is good to be back.
I missed you last week.
And I missed you the week before.
I know. It's been too long. Good to have you back. And good to have a whole slew of guests today. We've got a full episode, so let's dive right in. Samsung announced its upcoming Unpacked 2020 event just a couple of days ago. As most events in 2020 are turning out to be, it will indeed be a virtual event. They're going to be streaming it Wednesday, August 5th at 7 a.m. Pacific, 10 a.m. Eastern. Samsung has a whole bunch of anticipated products, or at least that I've heard of. We know one product for sure that we're going to hear of and others that we might. Joining us to walk through some of these products is David Ruddock from Android Police. Welcome back to the show, David.
Thanks for having me. It feels a little early to be on a Twit show in the morning.
I know, isn't it? Yeah. Well, this is our Thursday morning ritual. It's like waking up, a little cup of coffee, and then dive right into podcasting. You know, like we do at podcast studios. This is just how we roll. So it's good to have you on. I appreciate you taking time for us today. This event happens every year. Every year we have an Unpacked event at about August time, and it's usually the Note event. So let's start there. There have been a number of leaks with the upcoming Note phone. What do we know about the Note 20 series? What has you excited about what you've heard?
Well, I mean, we know a fair bit at this point, and what we really know, you know, kind of the headline features of the phone, it's going to have a 120 hertz display, which is, you know, one of the things that's going to be kind of a big deal for the spec geeks out there. High refresh displays are really a big, you know, new feature in phones that we're seeing adopted rather quickly. So that's a big part of it. We can expect a big battery. We can expect 5G. We can expect a ton of cameras, some of which are being carried over from the Galaxy S20 Ultra. You know, we can expect a Snapdragon 865 Plus processor, probably, which is, you know, the latest and greatest from Qualcomm. And when you take that all together with, you know, Samsung's ultra premium build, the stylus functionality and all of the other tech in there, that adds up to a big and expensive phone, which the Note line is historically known for, and there will be a smaller one too, as we expect happened last year with the Note 10 and Note 10 Plus. Though this year we think it's going to be the Note 20 and Note 20 Ultra. And as far as what differentiates them, you know, they're going to have different display technology. It sounds like Note 20 won't have the high refresh display. Note 20 might have a different camera system. I can't exactly recall. We can also expect Note 20 will have a smaller battery. It might not have a micro SD slot if last year's phones were any indicator. I don't know how much we've heard about that. And it's possible, if I were to be a betting man, I would bet that only the Note 20 Ultra will receive will receive 5G ultra wideband technology or millimeter wave technology in order to help keep the price down in the smaller model. And I think price is really going to be the big discussion about these phones. Samsung launched the S20 earlier this year at $1,000, and that was for the smallest one, and went all the way up to $1,400 for the S20 Ultra, which people at the time were like, that's a lot of money for a phone, and it is. So rightly, people are concerned, you know, how much is this Note 20 Ultra going to cost? It used to be that the Note cost more than the nicest Galaxy S phone. But as of last year, that kind of changed because we got the Galaxy S10 5G, which was $1,400, I think, when it came out. Correct me if I'm wrong there. Maybe it was $1,300. Either way, it was more expensive than the biggest Note last year. So Samsung is, you know, probably considering like how it wants to position these in its portfolio. And price is something you can adjust all the way up until the last minute. So we really don't know, and I've not seen any credible leaks about that. So, you know, with the economy the way it is and the global pandemic, you know, you really do wonder, you know, how many people are interested in these extremely expensive phones right now?
Yeah, that's definitely a big question that I've had. It really seems like so much of 2020, with just the way everything is playing out on the world stage, and then in the smartphone world, there's like a two conflicting battles happening, or maybe battles is the wrong word, but there's two conflicting kind of points of inflection. There's the mid-range territory where it's becoming really competitive and actually very compelling. And then you've got the higher end, which of course tech journalists like ourselves, we get really excited about the high end stuff, but you know, it's kind of hard to understand how that translates to the everyday user when, I mean, like just looking at what a Note 20 Ultra might cost, you know, that supports 5G, like I'm guessing it's more than $1,500. You know, once again, maybe that means that the goalposts move a little bit more. And that's just a lot of money for a phone, let alone in 2020 when everybody is price conscious right now. I just don't see people knocking down the doors of these manufacturers saying, give us your most expensive devices because right now we have the cash to drop on it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that. And I think Samsung, you know, it had a hard enough sell with the S20. Sales figures in the U.S. initially were not very good. Granted, a lot of that was due to retail stores shuttering. But in general, you know, these phones are expensive. And when you start, you know, ratcheting up the prices, even though most Americans buy their phones on monthly installment plans, the monthly cost adds up. And when consumers feel like, you know, their budgets are feeling tight, they start looking at those monthly costs again. And they decide, you know, if I can cut back somewhere, if I can buy a cheaper phone, or more likely, not upgrade my phone, that's what I'm going to choose to do. So I do think Samsung has a tough sale there for all but the Note diehards and really the group of smartphone enthusiasts that Note tends to attract, people who are using a lot of their disposable income on those devices. But, you know, that's not all. Samsung's going to announce that we expect at this event. You know, there's wearable stuff too. We expect a new version of the Galaxy Watch 3. I don't know that we know terribly much about it at this point. We've seen some pictures of it leaked. And we also expect the Galaxy Buds Live, which look to be more of a compact form factor version of Samsung's true wireless earbuds, which I'm very curious to try because Samsung honestly is doing the best job, I think, outside Apple in terms of the all-around true wireless earbud package right now. So that's actually a product I'm pretty excited for.
Yeah, my wife uses the first generation Galaxy Buds and likes them a lot. I know the next iteration was definitely an improvement. And yeah, you're right. Samsung's doing a really good job of kind of buttoning up and having tight integration between these devices, making compelling hardware that looks nice, that operates as you expect it to. There are a lot of other Android manufacturers that could, you know, would have a hard time saying that they do the same. So Samsung's definitely knocking it out of the park there. What about foldables? Because it was the last Note event where the Galaxy Fold, the first kind of Samsung foldable, was announced. Do we think that's a signal that this will also always be the event where the like predecessor to that Fold series will take place? And if so, what do we know about that?
I mean, we don't know much. We do know with a, I wouldn't say a high degree of certainty. I would say we're increasingly confident that Samsung's going to say something about Fold 2 at this press conference next month, because, you know, there have been more and more leaks of Fold 2. You know, we have some of the specs out there. No actual devices. Samsung's done a pretty good job keeping it a secret so far. But we do expect it will be announced. Now, when it comes out exactly, who knows? You know, supply chain issues may still be affecting Samsung. Granted, they're in Korea, where the pandemic has had a much more limited impact on business. But, you know, I think for Fold 2, what we can expect is probably, I would say, a bit of a polish on the original phone. You know, they're probably going to try to work out the issues that made the first phone a little physically weird, you know, maybe they make the hinge nicer, make some of the screen bezel, the physical bezel, because obviously the Galaxy Fold has a raised bezel around the entire screen, a little less noticeable, hopefully. And I know they're planning to switch to, it looks like, a pinhole camera so that you get more of that display. Granted, you already got a ton of it. And the other big change that people are expecting, the front facing display will be bigger and therefore actually usable. Unfortunately, the first generation's front display, if you've ever used it, it's, you know, for basic stuff like reading social media or an article or taking phone calls, it's totally fine. But if you have to type anything, it's just it's pretty comical. It's very, very difficult to do. So, you know, Samsung, I think, probably saw that feedback, and, you know, they probably already planned to make it bigger anyway. It was probably an obvious issue in early product testing. So I expect we'll see that. Now, this also goes back to price too, right? The first phone was $2,000. So, you know, I think economies of scale might bring that down a little bit. But if Samsung's, you know, adding these technological enhancements to the phone, you know, like a bigger front display, you know, maybe make it feel a little nicer, increase quality of the hinge, it's entirely possible this phone is just as expensive as the first one and possibly more expensive. We just don't know.
Yeah, and then that ties right back in with what we were talking about earlier, is right now the best moment in time for premium devices or devices that cost upwards of $2,000 to exist. It's like, on one hand, the foldables, you know, happened and people were interested in what this might mean for the future of smartphones. But then once the pandemic happens and it changes the economics of everything and the amount of money that people actually have to spend on these devices, it in some ways could really slow down or destroy kind of the chances of the foldable innovations that are happening. At least extending it out further, that might be what we're looking at. What is this that we're hearing about a lack of a charging brick? Because I know it's not just, like, I'm hearing some rumors that there's not going to be a charging brick in the upcoming Samsung phone. I think I heard the same thing about Apple not including charging brick. Is that right, Micah? There's also news on that as well.
There's rumors that that's the case as well. And there have been some surveys where folks have been asked by Apple, hey, what did you do with that old charging brick that you had whenever you went and upgraded your phone? So that gives even more insight into maybe Apple thinking about not including a charger. So yeah, this is interesting to me because I'm curious if other manufacturers are also thinking about not including chargers.
Yeah, I think that so I saw the story from ET News. I think it was yesterday, one of the Korean kind of gossip outlets. You know, we take everything they say with a grain of salt, quite honestly, though overall, I think their track record's pretty okay. I think Samsung, once they probably heard about Apple considering this, Samsung does have an established, you know, practice of looking when Apple does something and then deciding how can we improve on or ape on this and, like, make it, you know, make it something that is to our advantage as well. And I think with Samsung, what you have to consider is that, you know, they do have an advantage in that they are using USB power delivery for the phones now, like Apple, but also they're using USB-C adapters, which are essentially universal at this point in the Android world. If you bought a Samsung phone in the last, I guess, 3 years now, you have a USB-C cable. Now, whether it supports the fastest charge speed, you know, who knows? But generally speaking, Samsung has already made it clear that for the ultra-fast chargers, it wants to make you pay more money. And honestly, I mean, it's hard for us, you know, as tech people to speak about this because, like, of course, I have a million chargers. I literally have to give them to Goodwill every year because they start taking up too much space. But, you know, for your average person, there is definitely an expectation when you open the box that the charger included in there is the one that's best for your phone. You get a new cable because people destroy their cables, you know. If you don't have any mechanical sympathy, you know, it's really easy to destroy a USB cable over the course of 6 months. You know, we've all seen it happen. You know,
they keep using them. them. And it's a nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. And you like look at it, you're like, oh my, how could you let, just please let this poor, you know, USB cable out of its misery. But and the same thing goes with headphones, with earbuds. So you have people who have probably have not bought a pair of headphones in the last 10 years. Because whenever they've bought their phone, they get a new set of earbuds, you know, and they wear those out. And, you know, by the time they're ready for a new phone, they're cutting out in one ear, you know, they're crackling and, you know, they expect that new set of headphones. So I think what the rumor said was that Samsung was considering this on a market by market basis. And I think that approach makes sense because what they're going to do probably is survey customers like Apple is doing and figure out, you know, are there markets where doing this would make people, as the kids say, big mad? You know, do we have to take this into account? And I think that Samsung, you know, will probably, you know, find, I would guess that in some markets like the US, I think customers actually could be very upset, if there's not a charging brick in the box with their phone. I think US customers are very fickle. They spend a lot of money on their smartphones and they expect, you know, when they open the box for it to be the complete package. I think Apple has more of an advantage because they have a captive audience. They don't really care. You know, they'll pitch this as being a green initiative and say, you know what, if you need a charger, we'll give you one, this little basic one, you know, what it cost us almost to make it and ship it, you know, but if you want a faster charger or a fancy charger, you know, you have to buy one now. And if you want, you know, if you want your EarPods, you know, maybe they make those cheaper, you know, which is kind of what they did with the Lightning to some of the Lightning adapters, just to make sure that it's a little less friction for their customers. But I think with Samsung, they don't have that kind of brand loyalty, that kind of captive audience. You know, if it becomes, you know, a thing that Samsung stops including chargers and customers are mad, Samsung doesn't have the power, the brand power that Apple does to say, this is why we're doing this. We're not turning back. And, you know, unfortunately, it's just the reality of us, you know, wanting to be a greener, you know, less environmentally impactful company, whereas Samsung is, you know, has to respond to it on the basis of our customers don't like what they're seeing about the product and we need to fix that. So I think Samsung can try this. I think that for Android phone makers, it's going to be much more difficult.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see if this is one of those trends that we're seeing the beginning of. You know, it always starts with these little hints and murmurs and gasps, you know, when we hear about them. And then 2 years later, it's just totally the norm. I've seen this time and time again, rinse, wash, repeat. So anyways, David Ruddock, AndroidPolice.com. I'm sure you guys are going to be, well, I know you guys are going to be covering this announcement extensively, and I love your coverage. So thank you for hopping on with us today. If people want to follow you online, where can they do so?
They can do so at their own peril. Twitter.com, I'm RDRV3. You can also catch me occasionally on AndroidPolice.com. I don't post much these days, but I do write a lot of the titles. So if you see something and it makes you happy or upset or confused, you can credit me for that probably.
Or big man.
I would say that I've seen you posting less, but when you do post, I always read it because there's almost always guaranteed to be fireworks. So definitely check out David's work on Android Police. Appreciate your time, David.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon. Thank you. And I should also just mention as well, we're going to be doing live coverage of this event here at TWIT. It's going to be me and Leo. So that's Wednesday, August 5th, 7 a.m. Pacific. We'll be in our own individual studios following along with the announcement. So make sure and don't miss that. It'll be on the calendar. All right. Google held a showcase of its movement in the smart home world, its innovations, that sort of stuff. We're going to talk with Stacey Higginbotham about that next. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. Now, WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center 10 years ago, and it's grown exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab. The lab contains more than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs, as well as key partners ranging from heavyweights like Dell EMC, VMware, and Intel, to emerging disruptors like Equinix. Now, WWT is a trusted partner. They stay with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know that WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation, offers a whole host of things, on-demand and schedulable labs like Dell EMC, VxRail, Data Protection Central, and IDPA. These labs actually represent the newest advances in primary storage. There are hundreds of labs to explore, including multi-cloud, hyper-converged infrastructure, networking, secondary storage, data analytics, AI, and a whole lot more. Learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments so that they can quickly spin up proofs of concept and pilots using the ATC lab environment so customers can confidently select the best solutions for them. And in many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases speed to market in the end. They offer lab as a service. It's a dedicated lab space within the ATC, and this is where customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. It's virtual, of course, so you can take full advantage of ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. And WWT engineers work in these labs every day. They're beta testing new equipment. They're building reference architectures and custom integrations that are going to help their customers make decisions and see results faster and with much less investment. WWT has also launched a digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. It's an ever-evolving platform that creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world. To their customers and partners. You can get full access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and become a member of their growing community, go to wwt.com/twit. You can create an account and gain access to their on-demand labs today. WWT simplifies the complex. That's wwt.com/twit. WWT is delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly. All righty. What's going on with Google?
Yeah, so Google on Wednesday held its Hey G Smart Home Summit. I learned that while watching this keynote that they say Hey G instead of the actual phrase if you're going to title your summit after that trigger word. And Matthew Castanelli and I covered the event live. So definitely check out Twit's coverage of the event as part of the Twit News subscription. But I thought that we could talk about what exactly was announced at the Hey G Smart Home Summit and kind of what can the average person expect to see coming out of Google whenever it comes to working with the Google Assistant and smart home technology. And who better to do that than This Week in Google's own, as well as, of course, podcaster on IoT. It's Stacey Higginbotham. Hello, Stacey.
Hello, Stacey.
Hello. And, you know, hello. Micah, you got to come on This Week in Google more often because we say, hey, G, all the time there.
Oh, yeah. See?
All about Android as well.
I should have known. It's a thing. See, I didn't know it was a thing.
It took us a long time to learn.
Yeah, because I used to say, hey, boo-boo, but then someone, and I would say it in Yogi's voice, unfortunately, someone emailed and said, hey, boo-boo can still trigger the Google Assistant. So they had that happen to them. So I had to stop saying, hey, boo-boo. So sorry to those of you out there who may have had your Google Assistant activated. So we had this Smart Home Summit. It was a live event paired with on-demand content, and it kind of covered for developers what Google has brought forth in the smart home. And I thought it would be great to get your sort of overall kind of explanation of this event in general before we kind of get into the details. So tell us what was this Smart Home Summit kind of intended to tell folks?
Okay, sure. It was part of, instead of, there was no Google I/O, and there's usually a smart home component. And so this was designed to break out all those people. And I thought it was horribly efficient. It was just fantastic. 20 minutes of Michelle Turner, and I was like, oh, I know everything I need to know. And the big point here is to get us excited about what's coming. There isn't a lot coming. And then also to help developers figure out how they're going to build for this. So then we actually get the things that they say are coming. So think of this as like Developer Fest with a little bit of stuff for the rest of us to be like, oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I felt about it. Was like, oh, I'm so excited. Yeah.
So the most exciting thing for people who have Android phones, the next Android 11, when it comes out, you're going to be able to touch the power button on your phone, and you're going to be able to see your smart home stuff. And There it is. You're going to see Jason's smart home stuff.
I got to tell you, I love this feature. It is such a
great
feature.
Isn't it nice?
Yeah, I use it all the time. I have one complaint, though, is that sometimes it's a little slow to load. So, like, the page will appear, and it looks, and it's kind of like working to get the status of all of my controls. And it's like, I just need to turn the light on, you know, and I'm just waiting for it to, like, refresh. Maybe that'll get ironed out. But I love that feature. It's my favorite feature.
It's like, it's still in beta, man. Come on.
I know.
It reminds me, and Micah, you're probably going to appreciate this. It reminds me of Apple, which has had their HomeKit stuff on the home screen for 2 generations? A long time.
Yes. Yeah. At least 2 generations. Yeah, this feels like that. And that's why I was excited about it, because as a person who uses both of the platforms, this was one feature that I did enjoy having on my iPhone that was not yet on the Android device. And I will say too, and Stacey, you probably got excited about this. One of the points that they seem to drive home a lot at this summit, even during the keynote, was that state reporting was going to be incredibly important for developers. And so, Jason, you'll be happy to know that, because that means that it won't take as long for that page to load, because they're really driving home the point that each of the devices needs to be able to tell the system, hey, I am currently on or I am currently off, and this is the color that I am and this is the brightness that I am. So that way it's not having to go out and look for that information every time. That information will be readily available, and it'll keep that screen updated.
And this is super important, and it ties to kind of a big picture thing happening at Google with the smart home, which is when they killed Works with Nest and all the Nest devices were able to talk on their own to different devices, they really caused an additional latency issue, because now you had to talk to the hub, then you had to talk to the device the original Nest device was going to talk to. So they needed to, when they broke Works with Nest, which they did for security and access reasons, they had to rebuild all this. And they're rebuilding it in a way that's super awesome, because they're doing local. So local control of things. Most of the devices they announced are lights. And this is something they actually released the SDK back in April, and they announced it like last year. So we're finally going to be able to see this more often. So yay on that. That's going to be super fast. But also, this state awareness, which is important for local, is also important for presence. And Google talked about bringing presence back into the home with not your phone, but with devices that are already in there. So like the PIR monitor on your Nest thermostat will be able to say, hey, no one's moving in the house. Let's turn down. Let's talk to the locks and tell them to turn off. Maybe we'll talk to some lights and turn them on. So that's kind of the big picture of what's happening.
Yeah, I have to say again, as the comparison is drawn, one of the things that I've enjoyed about Apple's HomeKit platform is that it's a local area network communication framework. So everything happens on the local area network. You don't have any delay of having to go up kind of and talking to the cloud or the server and then having that information come back down. And like you said, routed to different hubs and bridges before it gets to the place that it needs to. So that local home SDK really had me pumped. In fact, leading up to it, I had kind of talked about, if there's one thing I want to see more about them talking about local connection and communication. And so to see that happen, I quite literally during the thing, I believe I cheered because it was very exciting for me. Now let's talk about kind of the one of the overall arching communication points, I guess, was privacy and security. They seem to really be kind of talking about how they want to make it so that there is a place where developers can sort of link everything and have it all in a console, but also for, if I'm not mistaken, is it also for consumers who have these products to kind of know what devices are using their location or this information and where they can go to sort of make changes to that?
We're going to have to look for more details on that. But yes, the broad picture, the big picture is like, that's what they're talking about. How they do it, we're not 100% sure. And there is going to be things that consumers are like, that will like, things like the OAuth will be, OAuth authentication between devices will be a little bit easier for us. So we shouldn't have to enter passwords as often. Google had been using OAuth, Amazon uses it, but their implementation of it should be a little bit nicer. On the security side, I'm really excited about for certain devices to have more access to data about your home. They're going to have a security audit, and they're going to have it annually. I think it's annually. And so we're going to have to see people maintain over time their security, and that's going to be great. Google's really following in the footsteps of Apple with local, with more talk about privacy, a lot of more focus on security. And meanwhile, in the smart home, you see Amazon, they're not talking about local. They do talk about privacy, but it's a little bit less. And the other thing is they don't have a phone. So I'm actually really interested to see like Google pushing in this direction a little bit away from what Amazon's doing. I'm curious to see the response there, both from consumers and developers, but even Amazon. What will they do?
Yeah, that's a good point. Because both of us are sort of watchers of the IoT space, and we see, you know, Apple does a thing in smart home, and then, well, typically it's kind of Amazon does a thing in smart home, and then Google and Apple try to do similar things, and then one of them does this thing. And so one of those examples is routines, the functionality that kind of, I want to go to bed and you do all of these actions, or it suggests things for you over time based on your activity. And so up to this point, we've seen over time, these companies kind of go in parallel with one another. But yeah, that's an interesting observation that Amazon without a phone kind of doesn't quite have all of the same functionality or tool set at its disposal. So that's fascinating. One of the other things that was really hit on was they hit on the shed, smart home entertainment devices. What's your take on that as a whole? Because I know shed devices have been something that you could, that the developers could target, but they've added more categories to that and they've added more traits to that to give more control. What's your take on that as a whole, given how much we are at home with our entertainment devices these days?
Sure. And, you know, everybody, I feel like there's this weird bifurcation in the smart home world where there's people like me who are like, ooh, lights, thermostats, cameras. And then there's people who are like, dude, let's talk about my AV system because it is awesome and it needs to be all in, right? And I'm like, oh, yeah. So I think that's important for that crowd, the AV crowd, which is a huge crowd. And it's also, one, we're home more often. So I think we're trying to access device or access content on more devices more often. So I don't know how many TVs you have in your house, but most people, I don't know if they have a TV for every person in their house. So there's usually someone trying to watch something quick, maybe on the kitchen, mm-hmm. on a display, maybe, you know, an iPad's not going to work in this situation. But, you know, there's lots of things that could become castable. And so that's what I think we're seeing here. And as a user, it'll be great because then you can just tell whatever it is like, hey, G, set up. I'm trying to think of the hot new show. Tiger King was so like a month ago. What's hot now?
Why? I don't know either.
Good question. Yeah.
Hamilton.
Watch
Hamilton.
Whatever's hot on Netflix.
Yeah. Hamilton. And Hamilton.
Hamilton. Well, I don't know. Does Disney play? Can I cast to Disney?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
It's so watch confusing. Whatever's popular on Netflix. That's a whole other topic.
See, we're kindred spirits. I can tell because you hit on something that's that is near and dear to my heart, which is the fact that yeah, I exist in the ooh cameras, ooh lights, ooh thermostats. But there is this portion of the community that is very into the set top boxes and the audio systems and the speakers and those kinds of things, and the reason why I think that this is important and why it's exciting to me as one of the ooh looky lights people is that there are a lot more people I would feel comfortable to guess that have a smart television than have smart lights in their home. And so 100%. Giving those folks the ability to understand the power of the smart home could make more smart home enthusiasts out of, you know, the average everyday person. So I love that there's going to be that ability to say, hey, G, turn on the show I was watching yesterday, or, you know, rewind 5 minutes and with those new traits that have been added. So this has me pumped for that for sure.
And for everybody who loves their AV system, but it has like 18 remotes and you're like, okay, first you turn on the TV, then you turn on the receiver and then you turn on the, this is great because you can, well, I don't, again, not sure how this is going to work up because I just moved in a week ago and I have not set up my TV and AV system totally yet, but I had a Harmony and the best part about it was actually when people came to my house, they could just be like, hey, G, turn on the television and like everything would go on in the right order. And nobody had to worry about the remotes anymore. So yes. Tiny little thing, but huge value add.
Absolutely. Let's talk about, as I call it, and my co-host Matthew Castanelli rolls his eyes whenever I do, PCHOIP, the Project Connected Home over IP. This was kind of
Oh my gosh, I've never heard that. Micah, you just hurt my brain.
PCHOIP.
PCHOIP, no, it's CHIP.
I love it.
Project CHIP.
See, but it's got an oven there. Or over IP. Yeah. P, Project Connected Home over IP. People just want to ignore the O. I see that. I like PCHOIP. I'm sorry. Anyway,
it's a nested acronym. Do you realize that?
Wait, tell me, what do you mean?
A nested. So there's an acronym within your acronym. It's Internet Protocol. So it's actually connected home over Internet Protocol. So in telco, you call that nested acronyms. But I tell you this only because PCHOIP broke my brain and I kind of dislike you for that.
Well, so CHIP or CHOIP, it is very clearly very important to Google. And I just want to note, as a person who had watched the Worldwide Developers Conference, Apple's conference a little bit earlier this year, they didn't really touch on CHIP.
They mentioned it.
On stage?
They mentioned it on stage very briefly.
Okay, that must be why, because this was a big point of this Google Hey G Smart Home Summit I was really happy about because it got me excited to hear more about it. But tell the listeners about the mention, I guess.
I'm going to give you a huge eye roll because I felt like they didn't say anything. I really wanted them to. We are still, basically nothing new is here. They announced this back in December. Apple, Amazon, Samsung, Google, bunch of other companies. And they all were like, we're going to get together. We're going to create a standard for the smart home and it's going to be awesome. and we were all like, yeah. And then crickets. And they did a couple panels in April and they were like, yeah, we're totally going to have something in fall of 2020. The first version of the certification will be out then. Nothing. Apple, they mentioned it on stage at WWDC. Then Google just did this and they just basically reiterated, hey, before the end of this year, we're going to have something. And everybody's like, they know they're going to have something. Mm-hmm. They said that in December. So what are they going to have? Give us some clarity on like, hey, how are you going to handle device provisioning? Does this actually mean that my smart speakers would be able to, could I trigger other devices with them? Could I have the same smart speaker and have it work with Siri or Google or Madam A? Like, these are questions people have. If you're a developer, you want to know, how do I bring this into my existing platform? Is this going to totally obviate the need for my own app? Am I now just a dumb hardware provider? These are big questions, and they're not answering any of them. And I'm super frustrated.
One of the things that I noticed is that they included the website, and I had gone to the website earlier that day leading up to this event, and it hasn't really changed. I think the only thing that's changed is they've added some more participants linked to the list. It's connectedhomeip.com. So there, it's definitely, you could see easy that it's CHIP. I suppose there's not been more news other than the overall thing to say, it's coming, it's happening, it might be here later this year. And now the FAQ says the specification will be available in late 2020. So it's clear, I guess the break that I would give them is that pandemic has happened. And so I'm sure it takes a lot more time.
Always had said fall. So late in 20, I mean, it may have gone by a month or two, but I wouldn't.
The one thing that I guess I'm happy is that the companies are still talking about it at least, and it's not just being shoved away entirely. So we know they're still thinking about it, right? That's good.
And we're not going to know. Think about these companies. Well, with the exception of Google, which sometimes does it, but Apple, they don't show you anything until they're good and ready. Amazon, they create weird stuff all the time and then just spring it on you, right? Google's a little less security focused. Let's be nice and say that way. their phones out, all that stuff. So what you have is these big players who think this is a strategic initiative. You're not going to hear anything until it's baked and done, I think. And that's what's happening. And it's a little bit frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just all the time I could talk to you about IoT all day if I could, but we do have to keep rolling along. So I want to thank you so much for joining us. If people want to follow you online and check out all your awesome work, where do they go to do that?
They should go to stacyonIoT.com, or you can follow me at GigaStacy on Twitter.
Beautiful. And thank you so much.
You spelled the name wrong.
Oh no. Is it spelled wrong in the... I'm so sorry.
I give you all my love, though.
We will fix that.
We'll correct that for sure.
I'll come back anyway. All right.
Thank you. Bye, Stacy. Alrighty. Up next, have you heard of Quibi? Well, you'd be forgiven if the answer is no. But before we get to that, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Hover. You can create a domain name that truly represents you and your brand. Hover has over 400 domain name extensions to choose from when building your brand online. No matter what you want to build, there's a domain name waiting for it. I have purchased many a domain name from Hover. And, sometimes it's just you say something on a podcast and it's funny and you think that you need a domain name for it. So I go to hover.com, I type it in. It's usually available for very little money. And I've suddenly got a domain name that if I choose to do something with later in life, I can. All of my domains are registered with Hover for personal sites and anything, professional that I've done. All Hover all the time because Hover is fantastic. It's super easy to use. It's low cost and I can trust on the customer service if I need it. Hover is a jumping off point for many entrepreneurs. And look, it wants you to start your business with a domain name that truly showcases who you are. You're going to find excellent technical support available to answer any questions you may have. And the support team doesn't upsell you. They only work hard to help you get online. Hover has free Whois privacy protection. That's one of those things that other domain name providers like to charge you for. You don't have to worry about that with Hover. Plus, a clean and easy to navigate user experience and user interface. Monthly sales on popular top-level domains. It's not hard to see why Hover is a popular choice for people starting all kinds of businesses. Keeping your domain name separate from hosting gives you the flexibility to choose the right platform for your business. Yes, get your domain from Hover and head elsewhere for your hosting needs. So that way, if you just decide to choose a different place to host your site, you don't have to worry about getting that domain name transferred. Use a domain name that truly represents you and your passion. Visit hover.com/twit to get 10% off your first purchase of any domain extension for the entire first year. That's hover.com/twit for 10% off your domain name extension for a full year. And we thank Hover for their support. You may or may not have heard about Quibi. And the only reason I have heard about it is because there's a great show on it by Chrissy Teigen, where she is basically Judge Judy. And outside of that, I've not used the app/service and have only heard about the downfalls, frankly, and missteps of the company. So what better way to talk about Quibi than by having Don Reisinger here as a Forbes contributor who has written about what we may think the current download and sales figures are for Quibi. Don, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, good to see you. How are you?
Very well. Very well. Thank you. So for folks, there may be some listeners out there who don't know what Quibi is. So let's start with that. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Quibi service is?
Yeah, Quibi is an experiment that raised $1.75 billion on the idea that people really want to watch short form, bite-sized content on their mobile devices. The idea being that's what we're doing anyway. So therefore, a new streaming service that you pay for certainly should be successful. And as we've learned very quickly, the last few months, that's not necessarily reality.
Yeah, so this article kind of starts by talking about some of the download figures and folks who have who have gone from being part of the 3-month subscription, it was a free offering, to actually becoming true customers and subscribing to it. The firm estimated it was, 72,000 who took advantage of the trial, and then far less than that who actually chose to pay once it came time to do so. So can we talk a little bit more about the figures then and why kind of things are may be bleak for Quibi?
Yeah. So the idea of Quibi initially was, let's give our early subscribers about 3 months free, 90 days free, and let's allow them to try this service out, love it, be enamored with it, and then pay us all kinds of money for it. The problem was, according to Sensor Tower, which is a data analytics company, they don't have official numbers, and Quibi was quick to point that out to me when I talked to them yesterday. But they estimated that essentially 8%, they estimated about 900,000 people, give or take, took advantage of the 90-day offer. And only 8% of those, about 72,000 people, actually signed up for Quibi and ended up becoming paying subscribers. So not good news, to say the least. Now, all in, they claim Quibi's had about 4.5 million downloads over the last 3 months. Sensor Tower does. Quibi says it's more like 5.6 million, and the number of people that are subscribers is an order of magnitude greater than the number that Sensor Tower says, but never provided any numbers. Mm-hmm. And either way, I mean, they were really too excited about something that raised $1.75 billion, had all this hype, and then ended up being something that, frankly, if you look at the numbers, absent the massive cash hoard, probably wouldn't be around too much longer. And frankly, for most of us, we look at it and say it might be a disappointment.
Yeah. So let's talk about then, I mean, under 1 million downloads per Sensor Tower, is that a low number for an app that has that much money, or even, you know, cast the money aside for what we know to be a popular app as a whole? Is under 1 million downloads just in general that is kind of a low number, right?
Well, I mean, let's put it like this. Disney Plus had 10 million downloads on its first day. So I think that's a pretty telling number. Obviously Quibi and Disney Plus are not the same thing. Disney has Pixar and Star Wars and all that stuff, but I mean, you know, when you raise almost $2 billion on an idea, which is unheard of, I think that there's a general expectation that things are going to go a bit better than 1 million in the first few days. So I don't know. I think that ultimately when we look at Quibi in 3 months since it launched, I don't know how anyone could really think that this thing has been a success.
Yeah, it really doesn't seem like it. Now, you have Sensor Tower, who did the reports here that you're writing about, a reputable app analytics company. You hear about Sensor Tower's, you know, numbers on a whole lot of different directions. So it's, you know, they're no spring chicken as far as that's concerned. However, their estimate on Quibi really differs from how Quibi itself is spinning this right now. In this case, like who do you trust more as far as what we're hearing about this? Sensor Tower, I feel like, has a reputation to be pretty solid for the most part with their analysis on this. So someone's not really telling the full truth here.
Right. Someone's not. And, you know, I guess you have to look at it from the perspective of they both have something to lose here, right? Yeah. Sensor Tower loses reputation. Quibi loses its business. And so I have to believe that, you know, the decision to launch in the middle of a pandemic maybe made some investors question. Then when they find this, that maybe things are not going as well as they had hoped, investors that may be dealing with some serious business problems or investment problems may be looking to Quibi and saying, you know, is my investment being properly managed? So I guess it's hard to say at the end of the day. Quibi, I asked them for specific numbers on the actual conversion, they wouldn't provide it. And so take that as you will. I think ultimately those of us who work in this industry know that there's probably some truth on either side. But the reality is, I mean, you know, Sensor Tower is a great company, but they don't necessarily have exact data. They're forecasting, they're estimating, they're doing some things. But at the same time, I'm not even sure order of magnitude greater is really a success for Quibi. And that's a whole other side to this. That is, what is your game plan going forward to turn this thing into a success? And we don't really have any real insight into that. And all they're really doing is producing all kinds of content that people frankly don't care about. So
well, that's kind of the big thing there. You do some of the numbers to say, hey, even if we go with this many people who subscribe, it equals this much money. And that's far, far, far less than the $1.75 billion. And overall, you know, there've been a lot of criticisms, I guess, of Quibi, but some of the big ones have been the fact that it was sort of targeted at this generation who is known for sharing content on social media. And Quibi didn't allow screenshots in the app. It didn't allow you to, in the beginning, share your screen from your phone to, you know, to cast it to a television. There were all of these sort of lock-ins to make it so that the only place you could watch it was right there on the screen. Do you feel, has Quibi been receptive to any changes at all? Or is it continuing sort of as if it knows best what it needs to do, which apparently seems to be finding new people to do more content with that, as you put it, people don't seem to care about.
Right. I mean, look, Quibi made a bet. The bet was people love short form content. They love celebrities and they want to watch celebrities engage in the short form content. What they didn't really understand or realize is that a lot of what that, you know, the millennial group that they like to go after and talk about, is doing is, you know, and younger, they're going to places like TikTok, they're going to Instagram, they're going to these different platforms where they're interacting with people they didn't even know. They're going to Twitch, who, you know, there's not a major celebrity on Twitch, but there are a lot of really, really popular game streamers who are really great at video games. You know, yes, this group of people really enjoys short form content, mobile first, all that. But it's never really proven to desire that kind of content from these A-list celebrities. Mm-hmm. In large part, they're looking at creating their own content, sharing that content with their friends and family, and then going off and finding people they don't even know, just an ordinary person who's creating really interesting, funny, compelling content and interacting with it. So it was a fundamental misstep that I think Quibi continues to make. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of that entire cohort, and what that means for this company going forward is something that I don't think Quibi fully understand. I mean, look at Cameo, right? Cameo is a massively popular service out of nowhere where High Pitch Eric, a character on the Howard Stern show, is making six figures. I saw it in the New York Times recently. You know, old wrestlers are making tons of money on this thing. This is not, you know, the world is not necessarily clamoring for interaction with A-list celebrities on a new platform. They're getting it from Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus. They're getting it from everything else. They're looking for interesting, compelling, different kinds of content on different platforms. And Quibi could have been that, but decided not to be that. And that's where they find themselves.
Yeah. Well, this apparently is going to be something that we continue to watch because Quibi continues to create content and doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
Yeah, not right, going anywhere.
Yeah. Doesn't have to go anywhere. With all that money in the bank, it can continue on forever. And here's the other side of this, and I'll couch this. You know, some cases, cash is king and cash can win. In the startup world, it's not always true. And I understand that Quibi doesn't need to make a lot of money today. They need to build scale and build a subscriber base. But ultimately, you know, Quibi could pivot. It has enough cash to pivot. It can change strategy and it could work out. But right now, in the first 3 months, it's looking like things are not exactly going well. And unless it pivots very quickly towards the kind of content people want, I'm not necessarily sure that the $2 billion won't dry up, or Quibi won't dry up before the $2 billion does. So that, I think, is the fundamental question going forward, regardless of the last 3 months. Where is Quibi in 3 months? Is it even around? If it doesn't pivot, I'm not sure that it will be.
Well, Don Reisinger, I want to thank you so much for joining us today to talk about Quibi's current state and perhaps its future. We'll see. If folks want to follow you online, where can they go to do that?
Yeah, follow me on Twitter, Don Reisinger, DonReisinger. So I have a little few newsletters we have called Snapshot, Snapshot News. You can find that at readsnapshot.com. We have a daily tech business newsletter. We have a weekly gaming newsletter, which actually comes out this afternoon with reviews and news. And then on Fridays, we do a little shuffle, we call it, with reviews of movies, TV shows, and games. So check us out.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Don. Good to see you.
Take care. You too.
Take care. All right. Apple clarifies the future of Thunderbolt on its upcoming ARM Max. We're going to talk about that after a short break here. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Your IT department has a very big job. More devices, more applications, a remote workforce, all with new threats and regulations, making strong security extremely complex. It's just complex out there. So luckily, LastPass provides your IT with strong security that is easy to use and manage. So you can secure every entry point from shadow IT to apps to mobile cloud services. Their access solutions give you visibility and control over every access point to your organization. So you can unify access and authentication. Employees access a variety of applications and devices, leading to a lack of visibility of user activity between each. Well, LastPass Identity actually offers a simple and integrated view across all access and authentication tasks. So they can see who is accessing what, when, and where. They know all the W's. You can increase security without impacting productivity. Increased security actually slows down employees, and that hinders productivity, but you can't leave your business exposed. LastPass's authentication solutions enable you to understand user behavior, so you can adapt authentication based on the user. And that, of course, reduces friction while preventing threats. It can make password security effortless. Passwords are entryways into businesses. So spreadsheets, sticky notes, those things aren't secure. Well, LastPass's password management secures them all, so you don't have to. LastPass allows employees to do their work securely when in the office or working from home. They're not going to store your master password, which means hackers can't get to it, and encryption happens exclusively at the device level before syncing to LastPass for safe storage, so only users can decrypt their data. LastPass uses 256-bit AES encryption. That's the same encryption type utilized by banks as well as the military, so you know you're going to get the most security possible. And of course, you know, we talk about LastPass all the time because we use LastPass at Twit. I've used LastPass since before Twit was using LastPass. I love it. It's just so easy and to practice kind of safe password management and create good habits around your passwords. LastPass enables that so you don't get lazy along the way. Secure your business and give your IT department the tools to keep your business safe. Visit LastPass.com/Twit. You can find out how they can help your business stay productive and secure no matter where your employees are working from. That's LastPass.com/Twit. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Oh, thanks, LastPass. I thought I would talk about this because it was something that I was worried about. So Apple, at its recent WWDC, Worldwide Developers Conference, announced that it will be moving slowly but surely within the next 2 years. So maybe that's fastly but surely to its own custom processors on the Mac. Up to this point, it has used Intel processors, and the move will take it to Apple's own silicon. With that came a concern. Apple uses a technology called Thunderbolt, which you may have heard about, and it allows for some really incredible connection and powering abilities that you would not normally get with some of the other types of connective methods. So with, you know, normal USB versus USB-C versus all, there are all these different connection methods, and Thunderbolt is an excellent way to drive display technology and audio and data transfer and also power the device. So for example, right now, my MacBook Pro is plugged in via its Thunderbolt 3 port to a dock that has all of my stuff plugged into it. It's got DisplayPort monitors plugged into it. It's got USB A, USB-C, my Ethernet, all that stuff is plugged into it. And with one cable of Thunderbolt 3, I can run that to my MacBook Pro and everything works. I'm suddenly connected over with the gigabit Ethernet connection. I have my, you know, my displays, all of it is connected. This webcam that I'm talking to you right now, all is through that. So all of that said, Thunderbolt is a pretty awesome technology. And the thing about Thunderbolt is that it is an Intel technology. So Intel makes the Thunderbolt chips. So if Apple is moving away from Intel to offer its own custom processors on the MacBook models and other Macs, then are we going to have Thunderbolt in the future? Well, Apple says yes. And it requires a little bit of a history check to understand that Apple and Intel were actually sort of the two big groups who pioneered the Thunderbolt technology. So Apple's quote says, over a decade ago, Apple partnered with Intel to design and develop Thunderbolt, and today our customers enjoy the speed and flexibility it brings to every Mac. We remain committed to the future of Thunderbolt and will support it in Macs with Apple Silicon. So there you go. Apple is saying that, yeah, we're switching to Apple's custom processors, Apple's custom chips in general, but that doesn't mean we're not going to continue to use Thunderbolt because, frankly, we helped develop the doggone thing and popularize the doggone thing. That, of course, comes on the heels of learning about the next version of Thunderbolt, Thunderbolt 4, and the next version of USB, which is USB 4. So there was some, you know, question about whether new Macs would only support USB 4 and not Thunderbolt 4. We all can rest easy knowing that Thunderbolt is going to be supported in future versions of the Mac. And that means I can continue to use my very lovely dock, even if I were to switch to a Mac with Apple Silicon instead. So super nerdy, but I appreciate you going on that tiny little journey with me as we talked about Thunderbolt on the Mac.
Yeah, at least it's not yet another thing to compound with the confusion in this kind of new era of Mac Pros or Mac computers. You know, the changes that will be inherent with Apple switching to its own silicon. This would be yet another thing. It's like, all right, it's too much. It's too much for legacy users, you know.
Yeah,
you can't exactly. But it does make me wonder, like, is there a point? Like, is there an end point that, you know, might happen? You know, maybe Apple gives a couple of years before it decides to go into a different direction. Who knows? And I know through looking at, like, there was an article that I think Scooter X posted in the chat room from 9 to 5 Mac that talks a little bit about Thunderbolt 4, not necessarily being faster than Thunderbolt 3, but improving nonetheless. And just kind of looking through these different iterations, you know, different versions of USB and Thunderbolt and everything, just realizing, man, it's getting, I mean, I realize the effort was, for a number of reasons, but one was kind of simplifying connectors, right? Everything uses USB-C and it's pretty easy to get that right. But it just also kind of makes it kind of confusing when you have all of these different standards delivered through a single, you know, type of connector. And
is it USB
the average everyday consumer?
Yeah, is it USB-C, USB 3.2 Gen 2? Is it? There's so many different tidbits that make all the difference. And I mean, I've got one cable here that is a Thunderbolt 3 cable, but it also works as a standard USB 3 cable. But then I've got another cable here that is, it's got the USB-C connector, but it doesn't do Thunderbolt 3.
Right.
And I've got another one that's not meant for charging, but is meant for data. I mean, even in the state that things are right now, it's so very confusing. I think the one thing I'm excited about is that, or the one thing I can be happy about is that Thunderbolt 4 and USB 4 are going to continue to use the USB-C port. So I don't have to worry, at least, about having to get new cables with new ports or new methods to plug in, that we can continue to rely on this USB-C style plug-in method.
Yeah. Good stuff. It's nerdy, but I like it. Good story. Mine's a little nerdy too. Do you remember Dogecoin? Do you remember back in the day that the Doge was like a meme? I think this was like 2013, 2012, somewhere around there. Anyways, Dogecoin was basically kind of a jokey cryptocurrency that probably never intended to be anything serious. I think it was more of like a comment on, you know, on finance than it was an actual like serious cryptocurrency. I mean, they used Comic Sans in the early days, if that tells you anything. Well, within a month of its creation in December 2013, it reached a cap of $60 million. Not bad for a joke. But ever since, it's kind of found its footing in different ways as an altcoin. So it hasn't totally gone away. It's always been pretty low value, though. At its peak, it hit, it hit basically a penny per coin. It was 0.017 cents per coin. That was January 2018 amidst Cryptomania, where all of it was just like going through the roof before it just crashed on down. It had a market cap of $2 billion. Well, apparently TikTok users are have a plan. There is a current trend happening on TikTok where people are going on TikTok and encouraging other users of the service to invest in Dogecoin. They say that the promise is that that once the coin hits $1 per coin, of what, you know, it would have to make up a lot of money there in order to get there. Investors would get a very lucrative return, possibly become rich, and all of these promises being thrown around on TikTok. Today, Dogecoin sits at 0.004 cents per coin. So not even a cent per coin, not even 1 cent. But they have seen a 40% surge in 24 hours. So there's a little bit of a lift going on here. Long way to go before they ever get close to $1 per coin. I just think it's interesting. Like it's kind of a interesting how like it kind of ties in with an article that I also read about Robinhood. And I've kind of been reading about Robinhood a little bit here and there about how the app, which is a stock trading app, has really kind of appealed to people who maybe weren't investors in the stock market before. But these apps and these, you know, and in some cases, these cryptocurrencies and the apps that drive them are created in ways that it makes it almost like a video game, almost like you're launching a video game and like, yeah, well, I'm going to, you know, speculate on some stuff here, and how you can actually, you know, lose big money when you do that. Mm-hmm. So buyer beware. But even Dogecoin's Twitter account is urging people to be very cautious. You know, they're saying, be mindful of the intentions people have when they direct you to buy things. None of them are in the spot to be financially advising. You know, you're opening yourself up to other people's FOMO or manipulation, that sort of stuff. So maybe this is just a cautionary tale for anyone who the Venn diagram of people who watch the show and are on TikTok taking their financial advice from other TikTokers. I don't know if that Venn diagram crosses very heavily here, but I think it's interesting nonetheless kind of where we're at right now with kind of speculation and investing, and that Dogecoin, who knows, maybe it'll become a serious contender. I'm not really quite sure I believe that, but if it did, big money to be had. That's what TikTok does.
Maybe, yeah. This scares me because of that story, the Robin Hood story about the young man that lost a lot of money. And that's just, I don't know. Now I can't even think of the name of the application, but there's an application that you use to sort of prove that you are who you say you are. It's an identity application. And so you have like a private and public key, and it was just acquired by Zoom. Anyway, point is, with this application, at one point they launched a cryptocurrency. And so I have like a bunch of these coins, these like Nova coins. Yeah, Keybase. Thank you.
There you go.
So I have a bunch of these Nova coins. And let's see. I'm going to go now. Let's see what it is. It's like 1 billion 400 million something something lumens. That's what they are, lumens. And it's allegedly equivalent to $127.74 USD. It used to be just $92. So it's gone up, but I'm just like, I don't believe it's a real thing at all. So it just sort of sits there. And I don't understand how cryptocurrency works, I guess. Nor do I want, I don't really care. So you don't worry about sending me an explainer or anything like that. This stuff just seems so,
it's like play
Doctor
money.
Who. Yeah, it's like play money.
It feels like
it's
play Monopoly. Money, yeah.
It feels like yeah. it, yes. So I don't really know what any of that means, but I guess if I am ever in a hard spot, I can go there to cash in my $127. I don't know. It's weird, but
it is.
And I hope that people are careful. That's a big thing, that people have to be careful. And I'm glad that Dogecoin itself is saying, hey, be careful, that they're not right. sort of feeding into it. That's good.
Yeah, I am too. I think that's really great that they're getting out there and doing that. I mean, anyone who's taking their investing advice from like a for fun, I think you could call TikTok more or less a for fun social network, right? Like everything that I ever see on TikTok is people just having fun, doing dances, different things like that. I'm sure there are all different avenues that you can follow on TikTok, but maybe not the best place to take your investing and financial advice from without a lot of critical thinking and research to back that up. And also just kind of understanding that cryptocurrency in general has a pretty storied history from what I can tell, anyways, from what I've read, with pump and dump, you know, schemes where just a lot of people behind the cryptocurrency understand how to kind of motivate and move behind the scenes so that people get really excited and invest more. And then what do you know? Suddenly everybody's selling all their cryptocurrency and those people made a lot of money, but then you're stuck kind of with this cryptocurrency that's worth a whole lot less. I'm sure there are crypto fans who will write me and tell me how I'm wrong, but I've certainly read stories about this happening, and this kind of feels a little like that. Like who's behind this kind of meme to do this? Or maybe it was really someone that just kind of did the math, and they're like, well, actually, it's so low that if we did get enough of a movement, we would all make money. And who's to say that they wouldn't? But I would be extremely cautious. And, you know, it is real money after all, if you're putting money
yes.
into this cryptocurrency.
Yes. So that's the important thing, is that we talk about it's play money. The cryptocurrency side feels like play money, but definitely the money that you put into it to get more of that cryptocurrency yep. is very real. And we should not forget that.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know what else we shouldn't forget?
What?
It's the Tech News Weekly, publishes every Thursday.
Oh, yeah. I see. I almost forgot.
where does it publish?
twit.tv/TNW. I won't forget that. Go there. That's the show place, the show page on the web where you can go to subscribe to the show, audio and video formats, podcatchers. You can link to all of them or a number of them anyways. And also link out to YouTube. Subscribe there. twit.tv/TNW.
You can also remember to follow us on social media at Twit. It's at Twit on Twitter, at twit.tv on Instagram, at Twit Talk on TikTok, where we're not talking about Dogecoin. And if you want to tweet at me, I am at Micah Sargent on actually pretty much all of the social media networks. So it's not just tweeting, but Instagramming and all the different stuff. Or head to chihuahua.coffee, chihuahua.coffee. Of course, be sure to check out my show, Hands on iOS, which also publishes every Thursday. This episode, it's actually leaking from my brain what today's episode is about.
Let's see here. I can help you. It's about the Satechi Trio.
Oh, no, that was last week's episode.
Oh, I see. Okay, yes, it hasn't published yet. So
I don't know why. I can't remember. Anyway, go check out Hands on iOS. I cover all sorts of stuff about the iOS operating system. And I just did an episode on the Satechi Trio, which is a very cool wireless charging pad. But more this week, even though it is just not in my brain for some reason. Jason Howell, where do people follow you online? And what about your show?
I feel your pain, Micah. I do it every single week. We get to this point. I'm like, damn, what is that episode that I just did? I have to literally dive into my notes to remember. Look, we do a lot of shows here at Twit. That's the main thing to remember. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. My show to plug would be Hands on Android, a new episode just published right before we recorded this show. And it's on Nearby Sharing, which is essentially Google's long awaited, because we want them to get it right, AirDrop-ish feature.
Which
Android has had an AirDrop-like feature in the past, but it had very low adoption or use by anyone because it was just weird and how they did it, and it just never worked very well. Now they have a new feature. It's only in limited beta, though, so not everybody gets access to it. I was lucky enough to get access to it, so I show you how to use it, what it is, how fast it runs, and how easy it is to use. So that's nearby sharing. twit.tv/HOA to check that out. Pretty excited about that episode, and it's up right now. Thanks to everyone who helps us do the show each and every week. Thanks to Burke. Anthony's there running the board this week. John is out, so thank you, Anthony. Thanks to all of you for watching and listening. And we'll see you next week on Hands. Sorry. We'll see you next week on Tech News Weekly. Hopefully a little bit later on Hands on Android, though. So go over there. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Be sure to check out the other shows on the network, like my other show, Hands on Wellness. I love to share different tips and tricks that's going to help you get a better grasp on your personal wellness. Just go to twit.tv/how and subscribe now.